Page 121 of The Unfolding is the story of Maya Mikhailuk.
The fear comes over as waves, and, you know, at times of the bombings, it's just scary. There's no way to escape fear, but then comes peace that is unexplainable.
God's story has been unfolding
since the beginning of time.
He invites you to be a part of it.
Another page in the unfolding.
Hi, this is Meredith Foster. At 5 a.m. on the 24th of February this year, Maya Mikhailuk woke to the sound of explosions. It was the sad and scary confirmation of what they had feared. Russia had launched an attack on Ukraine and war had begun. From their apartment in Kyiv, Maya's family could hear rockets exploding, something that's become a daily occurrence since the war started. Millions of Ukrainians have been displaced. Nearly 4 million refugees have crossed the border to countries like Poland and Romania. And for many, including Maya, the decision whether to stay or leave is gut-wrenching. Maya is the co-founder and leader of a ministry called International Partnerships. She and her husband have spent 25 years planting churches in Ukraine, and they pastor a congregation in Kyiv. She spoke with us from a bomb shelter in her apartment building.
Hi, Meredith.
Hi, Maya. Thank you for joining me. So you can see and hear me okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wonderful. You're in your bomb shelter, I see.
Yeah, we have right now no air raid, but I suspect that in 1 hour there will be one, so I might as well start here rather than move around.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, it's dark already outside. We cannot keep light anywhere in the apartment, only in this corridor where there's no window.
Oh, wow. Do you say you expect one in an hour because that's what's been happening in past nights?
Yeah, it's like usually we get the break for half an hour, then there'll be an air raid, then there'll be another break. So it's multiple times during the day. And the night usually is the worst. They start bombing around this time, closer to midnight,
wow.
Between midnight and 5 o'clock.
I want to talk more about that, but before I jump into it, first of all, thank you. I really appreciate your time and thank you for being willing under such extreme stress and circumstances. I'm really grateful for it. So let's start with your backstory. Did you grow up in Ukraine?
Well, I grew up in a country that doesn't exist anymore. I was born in Soviet Union and spent half of my life in Soviet Union before it collapsed. But you know, inside of Soviet Union, there were 15 republics. Ukraine has been one of those. And I was born in Ukraine, actually in eastern Ukraine, which was occupied by Russians actually 8 years ago. You know, everybody's talking about war starting just 4 weeks ago. The war started 8 years ago and part of Ukrainian territory. My hometown where I grew up has been occupied since the beginning of the war in 2014. I'm 51. I was born in 1970, still Soviet Union. The Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. That's when Ukraine became independent and, you know, Russia became independent. All those 15 republics became separate countries. But basically Russia, I shouldn't say Russia, but when Putin came, he kind of came with ambition to restore Soviet Union, if not, you know, as it was, at least as a political area of influence. So Ukraine up until 2004 was very much under Russian influence. And we believe that all the presidents that were sort of democratically elected, a lot of elections were rigged, and we had pro-Russian candidates winning those elections, and they were submissive to Moscow. And when we finally elected not a pro-Russian president, we had problem with Russia in 2004. And then, of course, in 2013, we had Revolution of Dignity when our then pro-Russian president Yanukovych he went to Moscow for a visit. He came back and he said, okay, Ukraine is not going to be heading toward Europe. We're going to go with union with Russia. And that's when students started protesting. And when they were brutally beaten up, all the adults got up and went also to protest. We were part of those protests. So, you know, all this started in 2013, basically, because Ukraine came out from Putin's sphere of influence. He soon after the revolution, after the former president Yanukovych fled to Russia, Russia annexed Crimea, and they started a military aggression in the east. All that with a purpose to keep us under their control. It's like, you know, you cannot join European Union, you cannot join NATO, you cannot really progress as a country when you have ongoing war in part of your country. And of course, now after 8 years, Russia has gotten more power, I guess, more finances, and they came full-fledged war and aggression.
So when you were younger and growing up, were you exposed to Christianity? Where did faith become a part of your life?
No, growing up, you know, in Soviet Union, I would say I had no concept of God. My father was a Communist Party member. I was active part of the Youth League of the Communist Party. At some point, I was actually offered a career in that area. And, you know, in those times, in Soviet times, to become a part of elite of society, you had to be in the political, in the Communist Party elite. So yes, I was growing up not having a concept of God. I remember, you know, maybe sitting on the roof, looking up to the skies, to the stars, and wondering if aliens exist. I read books about aliens, right? But I had absolutely no question whether God exists, just concept wasn't there. I was a student in university in 1992. That was a year after Ukraine became independent. We had a group of students from Biola, from Los Angeles, come in with InterVarsity Global Project. We didn't know there was Global Project of InterVarsity. We didn't know it was InterVarsity. But I was studying languages. English was my major. And there were 16 Ukrainians selected to be a part of that project. And we were roommates with 16 Americans who came to Ukraine. And somehow, I think maybe a few days before they came, somehow we found out that they were Christians. And in our atheism classes in university, we knew that all people who believed in some kind of God, they are uneducated fanatics. So we thought, this is going to be 6 weeks out of a summer vacation. Practicing English is good, but this is going to be really a very boring time with this fanatics. And I remember when the bus drove up to our dorm and the bus doors open, all this, you know, Christians started coming out of the bus. We were kind of shocked. They didn't look like Christians. They looked normal.
What did you think a Christian looked like? Did you have a picture in your mind?
Yeah, more like, you know, monks and nuns, you know, people in dark clothes, no smiles. And of course, American students, loud, laughing, smiling, t-shirts, shorts. It was a shock for us that they were normal. They were like us. And then, of course, you know, each one of us had a lot of time with our roommate talking about different life issues. And I remember talking to Carol, my roommate, and pretty much every conversation, like, what is the sense of life? What is the purpose of life? What brings you happiness? She kept bringing it to Christ. And her parents were the leaders of the group, Jay and Betsy. They were the adults who brought this group. So I felt like I spent time not just with my roommate, but in a family. And I can tell you, I was loved into kingdom. And just the love I felt from them, from people from, you know, the other part of the world who just 2 years ago in Soviet Union, we believe that Americans are enemies, right? They want to kill us with their nuclear bombs. And here I felt so loved by these people. And I kept asking myself, why? And then the love they have for each other, the love I observed. And they kept pointing me to Christ. And before they left, I talked to Jay Shaner, the father of the family, and I prayed together with him. Asking Christ for forgiveness, inviting him into my life. And I was the only Christian out of 16. I was the only one who came to Christ out of 16 Ukrainian students. And later we were One of the days we were on the lake together with Americans and Ukrainians and some leadership from my university, and Jay asked me if I would like to be baptized. And I thought, I didn't know it, but I felt like if I'm ashamed of my face, God will be ashamed of me. So I agreed, fully prepared that I'd be expelled because, you know, I was becoming someone we learned that is, you know, wrong and all that. So anyway, I didn't get expelled. It was already free time in Ukraine. I mean, there was freedom. And later, just very naturally, I started, I don't know, I think we had 8 Bible studies in dorm. And I don't know, like now we train leaders, you know, Christian leaders for weeks and years, encourage them, inspire them, and they still not take an initiative. And then it was like, okay, nobody's a Christian around me. I want to study the Bible together with others. And we were still in the days when email was not an option. So when we run into a question in the Bible study, I would write to Jay and Betsy, like, we have this question. What
you would write a letter?
A letter. And then 6 weeks later, we get the answer. We don't remember the question. But that's how many of us came to Christ. Many people came to Christ through those groups. It was absolutely just Holy Spirit, scriptures, and just, you know, discovery and hunger. And I know quite a few of those people ended up in full-time ministry. So that's kind of my walk of coming to Christ.
I want to ask you a couple things about that. You talked about how experiencing love, that you were loved into the kingdom. Had you ever experienced love like that before? What was your backstory like when it comes to feeling loved or knowing you're loved?
I grew up quite skeptical about love in general. I think I just somehow, I don't know why, even before getting married, I just thought, you know, love is some romantic thing that lasts for 2 years and then you just either tolerate each other or you divorce. My mom died when I was 16. My dad remarried very quickly. And I didn't get along very well with my stepmother and with my father. So I always felt kind of, I don't know, not loved, I guess, in my own family. So for me, it was just kind of a shock to experience love from people who, like I said, supposed to be enemies, or, you know, that's what we saw, or at least strangers, right? From another part of the world. We don't speak the same language. I was still learning English. But yet I just felt accepted and loved like I haven't been loved in my own family.
And when you said you were the only one out of the 16 who professed faith, once they left, did you know anybody else who was a Christian?
Well, later, a couple more people from that group of 16 came to Christ also through that Bible study that one of the Bible studies in our dorm. But I did have a pretty painful, I should say, experience with Ukrainian Christians. After I came to Christ and Jay and Betsy left and Carol, they encouraged me to find fellowship in somewhere locally. So I found a church in my small town, and they were very unwelcoming. And you have to keep in mind that the church in Soviet Union was persecuted, and they had to be very careful about newcomers. And the church became kind of very closed. And their children in Soviet times couldn't go to university. So almost like a doctrine was created that education is sin. It's a sin of pride. You don't want education. So here I come, new believer, baptized by Americans after a week of being a Christian, jeans, earrings. I mean, everything is wrong about me. And I am in the university. I'm not going to quit university. It's everything is wrong by the standards of that time. So they told me everything that was wrong with me. I came home crying. Oh. My husband, who was not a believer at that time, he wanted to go and hit someone for for upsetting his wife. So it was not a very good experience. So the Bible study groups became the place for me to grow. It was much later when I was able to find fellowship. But that's one of the reasons why we started church planted ministry later, because we felt that people who are educated, who were educated in the 90s and beginnings of 2000, very often didn't find a comfortable, welcoming place in existing church that went through persecution and was kind of looking at them like, you know, they were like souls and poles to them, right? People who persecuted them now come to church. And do you trust them? Do you not trust them? Anyway, that's another kind of backstory why we started the church planted ministry. We felt that, you know, we need new vessels for new wine. There's a need for planting many more churches in Ukraine.
So how did you meet your husband, and how did, were you married when you became a believer?
Yeah, okay. Yes. So how did I was married for 1 year when I became a believer, and my husband was not a part of that project. He studied in another university. So I called him and I said, I became a Christian. And remember, I told you I was a communist, Youth League Communist Party leader. So I'm calling my husband and saying, I became a Christian. And after a pause, he says, okay, I don't want to hear about it. You want to believe whatever you want to believe? Just don't talk to me. Don't try to convince me. So we had a very interesting year where he didn't want to talk about it, yet he would ask a question, I would answer. And I don't know, in Ukraine, women generally are more verbal. We can build arguments better than men. He'd get frustrated when I'm convincing. So they slam doors like, I told you not to indoctrinate me. And then next summer, Jay Shaner, the man whose family led me to Christ, he was coming with another global project to my university. And Nick, my husband, got to spend a lot of time with Jay in the evenings, reading the Bible. He prepared like a long list of questions to corner Jay to show that Jay was wrong. So I would see that Jay was wrong and everything was not right. But in the end of that time, Nick came to Christ as well. So a year later after me. After we both became Christians, we were attending a Christian conference for teachers. Again, Jay Shaner, the man who led both of us to Christ, he was a speaker at that conference in Vladimir, Russia. And we went basically to visit Jay, but because I was trained to be a teacher, I was graduating from the Teacher Training Institute of Foreign Languages. The conference itself was interesting for me as well. So we stayed for the conference and to visit with Jay. And toward the end of the conference, the director of the conference asked to talk to us and invited us to join Commission. I don't know if you're familiar. That was a big joint effort of about 82 mission organizations from U.S. Trying to reach educators in Soviet Union. We were asked to join as part of the equipping team. We were visiting together. There were Americans on the team and two of us. We were the only nationals. So we lived together in Vladimir. We moved to Russia. Oh. We lived together in Vladimir and we traveled to the cities where commission teams worked. And we helped Americans to transition leadership to the nationals. And we did this for 3 years, 1 year in Vladimir. We lived in Vladimir. Then we lived in Moscow. And I really liked living in Moscow. I loved Bolshoi Theater. I loved the museums. My husband didn't like Moscow. So we ended up moving back to Ukraine, to Kyiv now. Between those years, 94 and 97, we worked with Commission. And then Commission was a project. They were kind of winding down. And the leaders of that ministry asked us, does God put anything on your heart? You know, what is next? And we felt like, you know, the biggest struggle through those 3 years was that transition from Americans to nationals. And we thought, why can't we just start with nationals? Why can't we start the ministry with, you know, Ukrainians, Russians, Belarusian Christians reaching their own people? You know, we speak the language, we know the culture. And of course, financially doesn't take as much to support a national. So that's when we started in 97. We started the ministry originally as a Bible study movement, but then very quickly we saw that My personal story with the church was repeating again and again. People were coming to Christ in a Bible study, going to existing traditional church, not being welcomed and being turned off and saying, I'll go to the Bible study. I don't want to go to church. So we felt like we really need to start planting churches where these people, you know, they have leadership potential. They have been trained by Communist Party to be leaders. Now they want to use this leadership potential for the kingdom, but they're not given a chance. So we felt that we need to be, you know, planting churches where these people will feel that they grow and they will, I mean, everybody, when they come to Christ first, they're on fire, right? And we want to help them to start using their gifting and their skills and experiences for the kingdom. So that's how, after the first year, the ministry, we call it International Partnerships, the ministry from a Bible study movement became a church planting ministry. And we planted 25 churches since 2000.
Wow.
In 2000 was our first church planted. And it's not just me and my husband. It's we have a team of right now about 30 people in Ukraine. And we have two teams in Kazakhstan.
So you mentioned that a lot of the leaders that became leaders in international partnerships also had been raised up in that Communist Party youth league that you described. When you became a Christian, what was that like? How did that change? Was there backlash?
Well, when I came to Christ in 92, Communist Party was kind of on the way to be outlawed. So it was not something that was popular or desired in society. Like my father, I don't think he ever went and gave his, like, they have like a book that is showing that you're a member of the party. I don't think he submitted that thing, but at some point he stopped considering himself a communist. And for me, I think in our university, that thing gradually just disappeared. By the time I came to Christ, it was already non-existent, I would say. So it wasn't like, it was in my background, but not just from a leader to a Christian. I do believe that, you know, God has been preparing me for what I'm doing right now, even in the days when I was trained as a communist leader. And the ideology is a bunch of lies, but the skills, God is using them. God is using for his glory, for his kingdom.
You've kind of described what it's been like, 25 churches planted. You've got 30 people on the team in Ukraine and continuing to do Bible studies and plant more churches. That's kind of what you've been doing now for the last, 25 years?
25 years, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd like to fast forward to just kind of describing what your life has been like, let's just say the last year, and then how you became aware that hostilities were likely and what mm-hmm. that how that's had an impact on you.
Well, we have been involved in taking humanitarian aid to the eastern Ukraine in the beginning of the war, like 2014, 2018, those 4 years, we made regular trips to eastern Ukraine. So we have been in war zone. I'm a photographer, among other things. So I've been doing some freelance reporting for CNN at the time. So we were in dangerous places and under fire then, but we always came back home to safety. At the time when the war started, my son was 10. My daughter was 15, and I remember thinking that it's good that he's 10. Definitely by the time he's 18 and he's drafted into the army, this is going to be over. So he is 18 right now. Thankfully, he's in the United States, a student in the university. Otherwise, he'd be drafted. We have two draft notices for him. My daughter is 23 right now, and she just had a baby girl a week ago. So as far as when we realized that the danger is imminent, since the end of October, there's been a talk that Russia is amassing the troops on our borders. We were thinking he was bluffing. Putin was bluffing. He wanted Ukraine not to join NATO. He was demanding some things. He wants us to recognize his annexation of Crimea, so Russia would be sanctioned by other countries for that stealing of our territory. But as weeks went by, and probably by mid-January, we knew this is serious. When the embassy started evacuating from Kiev, that has never happened, you know, during revolutions or beginning of the war in 2014. Embassies never evacuated. Then Western missionaries evacuated. It was becoming obvious that it's a matter of days. Our daughter was in 35th week of pregnancy. We were trying to convince her and our son-in-law to leave, but they just didn't feel that that was the right thing for them to do. They felt that God wanted them here. So they stayed. Our son was here for the winter break. He left in the middle of January. He was really concerned. He's still very concerned, but he was very concerned about us as he was reading on the news in the States. And every conversation we had on Zoom with him, he was trying to convince at least his sister and brother-in-law to leave. But obviously, we're still here.
How did you make that decision for you personally and your husband, whether to stay or to go?
Well, we are leaders here. My husband is a pastor of one of the churches we planted. I'm also quite a visible Christian leader, both in social media and in person. We felt that it would be very demoralizing for people if we left. I mean, we had a lot of offers. We have lots of friends. Of all the people in Ukraine, Christian leaders have a lot of friends around the world. We were all tempted by offers to come, just have a 1 month vacation, see how things will play out. If nothing happens, you return. But, you know, especially when, I guess, Western missionaries left, we could feel how everybody in the church was, we understand. I mean, there is no, we're not offended. We are not criticizing them for the decision, but it hurt. Mm-hmm. And it became more scary when they left because it was just another confirmation that things are getting serious. And I think if pastors, if leaders left, it would be very demoralizing. I mean, talking about even our president, who is not a Christian, when he was offered by European leaders and president, I think, of United States, saying, your life is in danger, we can evacuate you. He said, the battle is here, I need ammunition, not a ride. I mean, if he says that, how much more should we be feeling that our place is here with our people through this difficult time? Mm-hmm. And we know, you know, from history, and we know even from the time of the beginning of the war, that when times are difficult, people are becoming more open to the gospel, more open to God. And we just need to be here to bring the message of hope. If we leave, then who will?
It's one thing to decide to stay before the war began, but another when bombs begin exploding around you. When we come back, Maya shares about the day the war started and their own struggle to know whether to stay or go. But first, a word from our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H Squared Leadership Institute. Almost every day you see a headline about a leader who has done something corrupt. Where do you think we tend to go wrong in our leadership journey?
Yeah, we are. I mean, it happens all the time around us. And there are some good people that don't mean to go wrong. And there are other people that are just like that. You know, they end up being in leadership. But even the good people that go wrong, I think popularity, notoriety, celebrity kind of gets to your head. It's not really a 21st century thing. Read the Old Testament with that in mind. You'll see how many people got into power and got into, became the king maybe, and then they abandoned God. But my example for the lay people, don't be a hero worshiper. We're all human beings. We will all fail. But if God is our hero all the time, and both the speaker and the leader and the layperson looking up to God, then things happen and we can go through it. So both guarding our hearts as leaders is the responsibility of the leader, and the layperson not to treat the leader as a hero or as a god. You know, that's what foreign gods are like. Sometimes we put people up as a god. Mm-hmm. So don't have a hero syndrome.
If you want to learn more about humility in leadership, Habib's website is a great place to do that. It's HabibHabib.com. And now part two of Maya Mikhailuk's story. So how did it begin for you?
Well, I guess the last few days before war, every night we were going to bed kind of expecting that something will happen. Though we still, you know, there were various scenarios analysts were presenting. And I would say, just recently we talked about that, I would say we believe that most of the push will come in the eastern Ukraine, where they already had presence and we are far away from it in Kyiv. But of course, on the 24th of February at 5 o'clock in the morning, we all woke up with explosions outside of our windows. And I heard my husband got up and I was still in bed listening to explosions. And I heard him opening his computer and not coming back. So I got up as well. And he said that he just saw Putin announce that they're starting military operation in Ukraine. So the war started and there were multiple explosions. And it was, I think it was rockets, Russian rockets that were coming to Kyiv. They were shot in the sky. So on that day, there was no damage of direct hits from the rockets. There was damage from the debris of the rockets falling. My daughter and son-in-law live next door to us. We have like our apartment is here. Theirs is next door to us. We have a corridor in between. So we got together here. We talked about, I can't describe. I mean, the heart was going fast. Well, our daughter was already 38 weeks at the time. Pregnant, and I cried a lot that day. Every time people called me, I stopped taking phone calls because I couldn't get through a conversation without tears. I could respond writing, but I could not talk. I was the most afraid for my daughter and for this unborn child. And even in the days before war, we were thinking, you know, what if it happens? What is our plan B? So we thought that we would evacuate to the village. Our parents of our son-in-law have a old village house 60 kilometers from Kyiv. So we thought we might have to walk because the roads are going to be blocked. We'll have to walk 60 kilometers with pregnant Sasha in snowy fields. And even before the war started, I was crying over that scenario. I had that nightmare in my head. And then the war started and you know, right in the next days, going to the store with her was like she was tired. Can't imagine doing a 60 kilometer walk. So, yeah, our son called from the States at that time, at 5 o'clock in the morning. We talked a little bit on Zoom, trying to console him. He was really going out of his mind as well, worried for us. And that day, I think we talked to him almost every 2 hours. He called us to ask, how you doing? Is everything okay? Are you alive? And yeah, the next night we had a louder explosion and like our windows lit up with fire. And in the morning we found out that a building not far from us got hit by the debris of the rocket that was hit in the sky again. And basically the whole face of the building, it's an, I think maybe 16-story building, just was wiped out by that rocket. So ever since then, bombings, night bombings are every day. Every day something gets hit. We find out in the morning what did get hit. And we spent the nights mainly here. Since Sasha and Nikita with baby Brianna came home, they decided they can't stay here in the bomb shelter. So they're staying in their bedroom. We put lots of scotch on their window. I don't feel like this is a safe situation, but they don't want, well, she doesn't feel well enough to sleep on the floor. It was really hard the last few weeks of pregnancy to sleep on the floor, but right now she's still recovering from childbirth, so she can't sleep on the floor, so they're in the bedroom.
Can you describe, first of all, you live in an apartment building, and can you describe that, your situation, how big it is, how many people, And then what you call the bomb shelter, what is that for you guys?
Well, we live in a 12-story building, which is kind of a smaller one in our area. The buildings are from 9-story to 28, maybe, in the area here. We have a bomb shelter downstairs. Pretty much every building has like a basement, and that became bomb shelters. But on the first day of war, we went there and we took a look, and there's no bathroom. It's just cement floors. It's cold. There's no water. We couldn't imagine going there several times at night with Sasha. And you have to walk. We live on upper floors. Shouldn't use elevator during the bombing. So we decided that we'll just stay in the corridor between our apartments. It's two barren walls. There are no windows. So we hope that this will hold. If it's just we went to see several buildings in our area that got hit. If it's just not a direct hit, it should be okay. Usually the windows and the outside walls get shattered, but inside of the buildings are okay. Of course, if you get direct hit, then it's nobody will be safe. But we just felt, you know, in the basement, if you're under rubble, who knows how long it will take them to get you out. So anyway, it's just, it's hard to think through all the scenarios and to think of the safest way.
Yeah. Well, it's even, it's hard to imagine even having to think through that scenario, that you're even having to think about these kinds of things. Whereas a couple of months ago, that wouldn't have been, you know, a part of your reality. I'm just curious. Yeah. I mean, you talked about crying that first day. Can you describe what you have felt and maybe how, you know, where your faith and where God has been a part of that, especially as you're going through the, you know, really that first day?
Yeah. Well, I wish I could say I only cried the first day. I probably cried the first 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. The fear comes over as waves, and it's, I want to say it's not fear for myself, but I don't know, maybe I'm just kidding myself. It's mainly, you know, fear for my daughter and for, at that time, unborn granddaughter. And just, you know, keep asking, have we done it right? Have we done everything possible to keep them safe? And should we have insisted that they leave? Would they leave if we left? I mean, it's, part of it is just a sense of guilt and not being sure if your decision is right. And just, you know, at times of the bombings, it's just scary. There's no way to escape fear. But then comes peace that is unexplainable, that surpasses the understanding. And I know a lot of people have been praying for us, literally thousands of people. We have churches in US that are partnering with us, but also through Facebook, since the beginning of the war, a lot of people started following and praying for Sasha, our daughter, and baby Brianna. So I feel like they're the most prayed mother and child in Ukraine right now. So I will say God became closer. God became, sounds became real. You know, we can understand David now probably much better than many other people on earth. There are still times when fear has an upper hand, and that's when I cry. But God lifts us up. I feel like, you know, there could be, and sometimes it's through people who are praying or sending a message, and sometimes it's just even talking to our daughter and son-in-law. Like, there was one night that we were really down, and my husband and I started talking to them. Okay, when you have a baby, how about then we consider evacuation? Right now, Kyiv is not completely surrounded. There is a way out. You can get out of Kyiv. We have lots of offers. And they were just, no, we feel God told us to be here. And then, you know, you go away from that conversation and ask God for forgiveness for wavering I think we understand our places here, but for our daughter, I would give a lot for her to agree to leave from here.
Any parent would. I think you don't even have to be a parent to imagine that scenario and what you're experiencing, and you'd feel exactly the same way. I've listened to other interviews with you. In one of those, you mentioned that, you know, a lot of people say or ask the question, are you safe? And your response to that, you know.
Yeah, there's no one safe in Ukraine. I mean, even if you move west, like Lviv is the biggest western city, a lot of people fled from there. We hear that out of Kiev, 2 million people left from Kiev. Some of them ended up in Poland or other countries, but a lot of them in Lviv. And Lviv has been hit more than once now. Russian rockets are reaching Lviv. And I'm not sure people can feel safe in Poland, because if you listen to Putin, he's threatening Poland as well, including with a nuclear strike. So really, the truth is, I should say, no one in the world is safe right now. Because, you know, with Putin against the wall, and you listen to some of the statements they're making, he's making, like, there is no world without Russia. If Russia is defeated, they they want to destroy the whole world. And they are, you know, rattling nuclear weapons. And hopefully this is just, again, a bluff, because it's not just one button, right? There's several people who have to follow the order to destroy the world. But with that madman in power, I will say it's not just me and my kids mm-hmm. who are not safe. It's everybody.
You know, you're so much closer to the reality of that. I think for many of us, we're literally so far removed. It's, you know, easy to be distracted by other things. But would you say living in the reality of that has changed your relationship with God in any way?
Well, I think when you live every day or every hour like your last one, it changes everything. It intensifies everything. It clarifies your values and your priorities. You begin to value every minute with your loved ones. And God becomes very, very close. And, you know, our church had 4 services since the war started. The first service we had to do on Zoom because we had curfew. The second service, leadership team in the church had to discuss, do we get together in person? And I was one of those people who said, this is irresponsible. We shouldn't ask people to come because there are air raids all the time. Like there is, there cannot be 2 hours without air raid. It's just a fact.
Can you describe what that means? When you say an air raid, what does that mean? A siren goes off?
The air raid, yes, the siren goes off outside for a few minutes, and we all get notifications on the cell phones that the air raid is on. Please proceed to the bomb shelter, nearest bomb shelter. So, and then, you know, we've been at this for 4 weeks, and this happens many times during the day, many times during the night. We are becoming more and more kind of numb to that. People just disregard it. But every time it's announced, something is flying in our direction. Something is going to be either hitting the building or ground, or a rocket will be shot in the sky and it will fall on the building or on the road. So especially in the beginning, people were really, you know, scared. The siren gets your nerves big time. People were really going to the shelters. Right now, not so much, though we should be. But that first Sunday, we had to make a decision. Do we get together? And majority decided that we needed to get together. And not everybody could come, only people who could walk to the church, because public transportation didn't work at that time. It's pretty limited right now as well. But on that second Sunday, it didn't work at all. But when people came, it was such a breath of fresh air. People just felt so encouraged, such a mountain of fears just dropped off the shoulders. And we were praying and singing, worshiping God together. Air raid came. Nobody paid attention. I mean, we could hear the sirens. We could hear all the phones ding with the warning. Nobody stopped. We just stayed together from 10 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon when people started leaving. after fellowship. And there is value of fellowship right now like never before. People just cling to each other. They want to be together, and that's where you feel the safest, when you're together and you feel protected by God. And the same, you know, in the middle of danger, first, you know, your heart goes fast, and then you pray and you feel God's presence, you feel reassurance, and you calm down, you begin to experience peace.
What are typical days like? You've mentioned the air raid siren goes off multiple times a day, and that's part of it, but are people, is anybody like working their job, or can you get food? And, you know, what is your typical day like
well,
now?
The jobs, this week, I see that more and more little businesses open. Interestingly enough, the first businesses that opened are coffee shops, and people are standing in lines to get a cup of coffee. Just a sip of something normal, right? We can make coffee at home, but there's something special about that. It's like the taste of life before. More and more hairdressers are beginning to work, and all of us are eager. Like, I'm one of those. I can't wait. I'm a month's overdue with my haircut. Stores are working. Drug stores are working. Construction material stores are working. More and more public transportation begins to work. That's, I'm talking about Kyiv. You know, you look at Mariupol, that the city that Russians wiped off the earth. Nothing is working there, no infrastructure. But talking about Kyiv, more and more life is getting not back to normal, but there's some life. Lots of volunteer centers are offering food to people who are in need, who cannot buy. Lots of restaurants are opening, well, I wouldn't say lots, but some restaurants are opening certain hours where people can come and eat for free if they are in need. When my daughter and son-in-law were in the hospital, it was restaurants providing food to the hospital because they, for security reasons, they don't allow relatives to bring any food. So the food there, Sasha and Nikita were saying, was some of the best food they had from some very expensive restaurants that normally they wouldn't go to. So we see a lot of people are supporting each other. People are really, it's not every man for himself. It's people are watching out for each other. And that's what we see. You know, there's a transformation in the hearts of Ukrainians. I believe it's a beginning of revival. We go around the city right now. We see billboards. Somebody's paying for those billboards with Bible verses from Psalms. We hear people talking about God is with us. God will be will do justice. He will strike Russian army. He'll strike Putin. So right now there are no atheists in Ukraine. Everybody believes in God, not in Christ. They don't understand everything, but they believe God exists. And this is much more than what we had before war. And I think it's important for church to be here when God does give us victory, to remind people who gave us this victory, that it's not our courage, it's not our kindness and care for each other, but it's really a victory given by God. Because if you look at the army of Russia, their numbers, sheer numbers, equipment, people, you know, everything, and Ukraine, it's David and Goliath. Everybody understands that. I mean, the West was giving us 4 days. Russians thought they would defeat us in 2 days. The West thought four, maybe 7 days. Then maybe 10 days after the war started, I was reading Western media saying, oh, we are really admiring Ukrainian courage, but by the end of the week, they're going to be done. That's in the end of 2 weeks. Now it's 4 weeks. We're not done. And I believe that we're winning. I mean, we're still, we're being showered by bombs and rockets, but our army is holding on the ground. So definitely God does this battle. And we need to remember that when the war is over, because you know how people are, you know, things will get good and we'll say, good job. Ukrainians are so courageous and, you know.
Well, one of the things I'd like to ask is, you've talked about feeling and sensing the power of prayer. And so I'd love to know specifically how we can be praying for you and your family and for Ukraine, and then how we could practically help if there's some ways we can do that too.
Well, we definitely need prayer, prayer for peace, but please be specific for peace, not at any cost, because sometimes when people pray for peace between Russia and Ukraine, we keep reminding them that there are two ways the peace could be achieved. Either Russia defeats Ukraine, destroys Ukraine, or Russia just goes home and leaves our land. So please pray for our defenders to be protected by God, to be given courage and ability to push the enemy back to Russian territory. We are praying that God would strike the enemy. I mean, we are praying like David for the enemy army to be confused and to run in fear back to Russia. Pray for people who are missing, a lot of people on the territories, like in Mariupol or suburbs of Kyiv, were hit really hard. We have, every time we get together as a church, our list is growing of people who are missing, relatives and friends who are either on occupied territories or we don't know what's happening. They're not responding on their cell phones. Mm. For the church, please pray for courage to stay, not to waver, to be able, you know, we are here to help people deal with fears, but we also have fears. So pray for courage, pray for God's peace in our hearts as well. Just those are some of the things. And I would appreciate prayers for my daughter, Sasha, son-in-law, Nikita, and granddaughter, who's 1 week old, Brianna, and our son, Daniel. He's a student in the States, and I know he's under a lot of pressure. Being away, I'm sure it's maybe even worse in some ways.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned praying specifically that Russia would be defeated. Do you ever think about if they aren't, if what your future might look like? Do you have a sense of what that might look like?
Well, we think that Russia cannot defeat Ukraine, because if it does, there is no future. Basically, you know, if you listen to them, they want to destroy, they want to kill Ukrainians, and especially the people who are opinion makers, activists in Ukraine. Like even before the war, we were getting reports from foreign intelligence is saying that Russians are making plans for prison camps for people like myself, who are have quite a following on Facebook, you know, for pastors, for journalists. So they were saying, and they're saying right now, that's what they're doing in occupied territories. They're saying some people will disappear and some will go to prison camps. So it's like, I think the former prime minister of Israel, Myers, she said, we are set to stay alive and our enemies want us dead. So there isn't much room for compromise. Either Ukraine will exist or we'll just be extinct. So there's not much a choice there. That's why our defenders, I think, really, I mean, they're fighting for every centimeter.
There were times during our interview that I got so engrossed in Maya's story that I completely forgot her circumstances. And then reality returns, the reminder that at any moment she could hear an air raid siren and explosions. It just added to my admiration for Maya and her family for doing what they believe is right, staying to serve the people that they pastor. I asked Maya about practical ways that we could help. Their ministry, International Partnerships, is providing aid in Ukraine. So if you'd like to donate, 100% of funds can be designated for humanitarian aid. Just visit ipministry.org and click the donate tab. And if you'd like to learn more about Maya, she posts pretty much every day on Facebook and Instagram. Thank you to Maya for sharing her story. Also, big thanks to former guests on The Unfolding, Randy and Monica Zachary. They connected me with Maya. Randy has been recording interviews with her periodically and posting those on their Facebook and YouTube pages. At the time of this recording, best estimates are that 10 million Ukrainians have been displaced, 6.5 million are within Ukraine, another almost 4 million who've sought shelter in bordering countries. As I was working on this story, I had the privilege of being connected with Andy Carr. Andy is Vice President of Development and Marketing with Feed My Starving Children. This organization is providing vast amounts of relief to hungry refugees. One thing we haven't talked about in this episode is the pending food crisis. Ukraine and Russia produce about a third of the world's wheat supply. The war in Ukraine threatens to unleash what the United Nations call a hurricane of hunger and meltdown of the global food system, which will, of course, impact the most impoverished people on the planet. Feed My Starving Children has committed to ship 4.5 million meals to Ukraine and neighboring countries, and requests for more are expected. So if you'd like to read more about what they're doing, find out how you can help, visit fmsc.org/Ukraine. Thanks to all who helped make The Unfolding possible. Producer Jason Rakow, Danielle Perez, Elena Nowlin, and our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H Squared Leadership Institute. He can help you unleash the full power of your leadership potential. Learn more at HabibHabib.com. The Unfolding is produced by Northwestern Media, a ministry of the University of Northwestern St. Paul. We'll be back next week with another page of The Unfolding.